is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Story. And, well, we're going to spend some time on Vince Lombardi. On this day in history, he retired, and Hengler has come up with his usual excellent produced piece on Coach. Here it is.
I'll tell you something, Leroy. You're not going to get your job back unless we get a better performance.
Come on, let's beat him up there.
Oh, God. Get him out of there, will you?
Hey, what about that now?
Vince Lombardi was born in Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn, and went on to be the icon of winning and success in America and throughout the world. This is his story, as told by his players, his family, and himself.
Interference!
Our narrator is the unmistakable voice of John Facenda. And why not? The man nicknamed the Voice of God could take classic sports footage and make it even more unforgettable. So let's begin. Here's John Facenda.
Vincent Thomas Lombardi, 1913. He was born on June 11th in Brooklyn, New York. His godfather was Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons, a legendary racetrack figure who trained three Derby winners. When he was eight, he was an altar boy at St. Mark's Church. He wanted to be a priest.
Here's Vince's mother, Mrs. Matilda Lombardi.
He wanted to be a priest, then all of a sudden, that was off.
Lombardi was an all-city fullback at St. Francis Preparatory High School, and then accepted a scholarship to Fordham University in the Bronx to play for the Fordham Rams and their coach, Jim Crowley, one of the four horsemen of Notre Dame in the 1920s. Here's Tim Cohane, the former publicity director at Fordham University.
Those days, Fordham had a play in which Lombardi, as the right guard, had to block the Pittsburgh left tackle, Tony Matisse, who was 215, 220, an All-American player. Lombardi weighed about 172. And in trying to block Matisse, or in blocking him, Vince received severe cuts inside his mouth to the extent that he played almost 60 minutes with a mouth full of blood. I think the point in that is that there's nothing that Lombardi has demanded of the Packers that he didn't demand of himself in full measure in his own playing days.
In 1937, he graduates cum laude from Fordham. He goes to law school, marries, and is forced to find work. He coaches at St. Cecilia's High School in New Jersey and teaches Latin, physics, and chemistry. In 1947, he returns to Fordham as an assistant coach. In 1949, he goes to West Point as an assistant to Red Blake.
Lombardi gave all the credit for his football success to Army's Red Blake and his time at West Point Academy. In 1954, Lombardi became an assistant for the New York Giants, but saw himself as a head coach.
For 5 years, Lombardi searches impatiently for a head coaching position. He's rejected for one reason or another. In February of 1959, he arrives in Green Bay, head coach and general manager of a team that hasn't seen a winning season for 11 disastrous years. A team with no direction, no future, and no morale.
Here's Paul Horney.
We knew from the outset that he was in command, a take-charge guy, and a guy that you couldn't fool around with.
Here's Vince.
I didn't come in and have a meeting with the players and say, myself, I wonder what their morale was going to be. I wonder how they're going to accept me. That wasn't what I said to myself. They're going to have to accept me. I'm not worried about their morale. I'm worried about Vince Lombardi's morale here.
Alone, Lombardi resuscitates a disorganized, depressed, dying team. He force-feeds the Packers with his will to work, his demand for discipline, his relentless drive to win. By summer's end, the Packers are Lombardi.
Here is Jerry Kramer.
We were graded, of course, every play of every game throughout the year. And on Thursdays, the grades would be posted on the blackboard for every eye to see.
Get him out of there, will you?
Perhaps this was the start of something, instilling some pride in the individuals.
Here again is Paul Horning.
He's always said that you can't play a football game on Sunday. You have to start playing that football game on Tuesday, the first day of practice.
Come on, look at me. All right.
And he's always believed that there's only two things that come before football. That's your religion and your family. There's only one job, and that's football.
Here again is Matilda Lombardi.
Somebody said he made football players out of some men, and he made men out of some football players. I think he's much more proud of the fact that he made some men out of football players.
Here's the great Bart Starr.
He tells you that if you give anything less than the best that you have within you at any time, regardless of the situation, regardless of the consequences, that you're cheating yourself, you're cheating your teammates, you're cheating professional football, and you're cheating the fans who have made the game what it is today for you. But most of all, you're cheating your maker who gave you that God-given talent with which to succeed.
Here's Vince.
Anybody who has the idea that just to play or just to take part and that's all that's necessary, I think he's in the wrong business. I think he's in the wrong country. One of the things that made America great is to try to be the best in everything that they do. And the best, again, is signified by winning.
Here again is Jerry Kramer.
I've made the statement at times, his gifted children, and I think he thinks of everyone on the club as a child, or his child particularly. And he drives his gifted people so much harder than he does anyone else. He demands that you use your God-given ability the best you can.
Here's Willie Davis.
He's a coach that I'm sure that have prepared a lot of us to go out and live in a competitive society. He taught us a lot of values about life.
As head coach and general manager of the Green Bay Packers, Lombardi led the team to 5 NFL championships. And like all good things, even the best things, well, this happens.
Green Bay Packer football, as all of football, has grown in leaps and in bounds since 1958. The season begins.
Take a good, hard look. Vincent Thomas Lombardi, head coach and general manager of the Green Bay Packers. A winner. To every task, he brought the desire, the dedication, the discipline to succeed. He never coached a losing team.
Because of the nature of the business, and because of the growth of the business, and the corporate structure of the Packers, I believe it is impractical for me to try to do both jobs, and I feel I must relinquish one of them.
How about regrets?
If I had to do things all over again, I think I would be very, very... I think I would pray for more patience, maybe, and more understanding. I think these are the two areas where I could improve a great deal, and I've been trying to, believe me.
Vincent Thomas Lombardi, February 1st, 1968.
On this day in history, Vince Lombardi retired. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Great job on this one, Greg. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and we're back with our This Day in History segment brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution's great literature, all the things that matter in American life. Today we're celebrating the life of the late, the great Vince Lombardi. The Lombardi Trophy, after all, was named after him. A lot of folks don't know who he is. And whether you like football or not, it's not going to matter when you hear this life story. Known by many to be perhaps the greatest football coach of all time, in 1959, in Lombardi's first year ever as head coach, he took the Green Bay Packers through their first winning season in 14 years. He then went on to win the NFL championship game in 1960, the world championships in 61, 62, 65, 66, and 67, and let's not forget that they won the first two Super Bowls. Lombardi wasn't just the greatest football coach in history because he inherited the best team. He had to build it from scratch. And because Lombardi had vision and faith in that vision and could communicate that vision and execute on it, he was the man he was. Here today to discuss the leadership qualities and styles of Lombardi is Pat Williams, co-owner of the Orlando Magic and author of over 80 books on leadership, including Vince Lombardi on Leadership, Life Lessons from a 5-time NFL Championship Coach, one I highly recommend you pick up. Pat, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Lee. Nice to talk to you. I hope you're doing well.
Oh, you bet. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, Coach Wooden, which was a whole lot of fun. And I think this one might be equally fun, Pat. A very different man with different style. But my goodness, in the end, how he made men better. Let's, if we can, talk from the start. Vince Lombardi didn't just fall into the Packers job. It was a long and, let's just call it, a strange journey.
Tell us a bit about this man.
Well, he was from Brooklyn, and he played football in high school, and then went to Fordham in New York and had a wonderful career, really, as a player. There wasn't really much of pro football around, so he went into teaching and coaching at the high school level, you know, across the river in North Jersey, and had good success. He was an excellent teacher, by the way, and coached football and coached basketball. So he had a wide range of teaching and coaching experiences. Then, after World War II, he had the opportunity, his first opportunity, to get into college coaching. He became an assistant at his alma mater, Fordham University, and spent a year or two there, and then got a big break by being hired by Red Blake, who was the head football coach at Army at West Point. And he had a good run there. In the meantime, he was seeking out head coaching jobs. He was getting up in years. He was in his late 30s, approaching 40, and wanted to become a head coach, and nothing opened for him. He did some interviewing, but never got that opportunity. And then he got another big break when the New York Giants hired him, his hometown team, and hired him as an assistant coach. At the same time, they hired Tom Landry. So you can imagine these two great young and getting a little bit older assistant coaches were there. The Giants had good success. They had a good run. And finally, Lombardi got some interviews with NFL teams, and at the age of 45 years of age, the Green Bay Packers hired him in 1959.
And Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or Green Bay, Wisconsin, I should say, is a far cry from northern New Jersey and New York City. This was a big change and a big lifestyle change for Coach Lombardi, wasn't it, Pat?
Well, it was huge, and I think his real dream was to coach the Giants. I think probably Tom Landry wanted the same thing, but they had a head coach, and they weren't going to fire him. And so both of them had to move on. Landry went to Dallas, of course, and took over the expansion Cowboys. And there was Vince Lombardi with his really great first real good opportunity, but it was in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So that's where he landed. His dream to be a head coach was right there for him. In addition to being the head coach, he had full authority as the personnel director and the general manager. Had an understanding with a very previously meddlesome board of owners up there that Lombardi was the voice and the decision maker. And so he had full power and took over a struggling franchise that had a tough go of it. And over time, not much time really, set standards in coaching and success that well, we haven't seen the likes of.
You know, Sonny Jurgensen, who played for Coach when he went to Washington, said, quote, "I think his background as a high school teacher helped make him a great head coach in the NFL. Talk about that, Pat.
Well, listen, Lombardi himself said, they call it coaching, but it's really teaching. And everybody who ever played for him in Green Bay, and then that one year in Washington before his death, would tell you that he was just a superb teacher. At clinics, they still rave about how he would sit there or be there, you know, for hours on end describing one play, for example, and what every player should be doing and all the little minutiae that went into it. He was just a crackerjack teacher. But in addition to that, Lee, he was teaching life. As I did all the interviews with the old Packers on this book, it was amazing. You know, they learned football under him, and they took away a lot of football lessons. But what they really said is that he was preparing us for life. Long after our football careers, he was getting us ready for the long pull of our life. And those lessons that he taught us through football, you know, are still with us today.
Yeah, and how many men can say that they have men who are still teaching and coaching us on life and not just our careers, Pat? You know, I wanted to relay a story. David Moranis' book has a story in it of Coach Lombardi at West Point. He's an assistant at West Point, you know, coaching office for this legendary head coach. And his job is to run game film to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City, to run it to a pretty famous general. And Pat, this is back when generals were generals. big generals. Talk about the role of that general, Douglas MacArthur. Because can you imagine a young man having to like knock on a door and the door opens and it's Douglas MacArthur and then you sit and watch game films together? Talk about Douglas MacArthur if you could, Pat.
Well, first of all, MacArthur was a huge Army football fan, even during World War II when he was anchored in the Pacific. You know, he kept up with it every week and wanted to know what was going on. So he was a huge, huge Army fan, and sure enough, you know, Lombardi was, you know, just cutting his teeth as an assistant, and one of his assignments was to drive the film each week down to New York so that Douglas MacArthur could watch the games. That was long before television, of course, and long before ESPN, you know, where everything is recorded, but that was a big deal to MacArthur to get that film brought into him, and that was one of Vince Lombardi's assignments.
Well, and you know, in the end, West Point, and we told a great story back when we were doing Roosevelt. If you remember, Roosevelt thought football was so important in the formation of men's character, in the formulation of, in the end, really a good military force. So I think probably Douglas MacArthur's affection for football was what it meant to the institution West Point, and the what West Point meant to our U.S. military, Pat.
Well, and so many of those generals, you know, took part in sports. You know, Eisenhower, for example, went there and played football until he got injured. So football was and still is a big deal at West Point, and it meant a lot. It meant a lot to the entire United States Army, and still does. The Army-Navy rivalry is alive and well, and always will be so. So Lombardi had a few years of that, and he made the most of it. So when his time came to go to the Giants as an assistant, you know, he was ready and made his mark there. Those old Giants, and I got to a few of them in writing this book. There are not many left. Frank Gifford is gone now. I talked to Roosevelt Greer. I had talked to Sam Huff, Bob Schnelker. I mean, there are very few. But they all had vivid memories. I talked to Pat Summerall before he died, and they all had vivid memories of Vince Lombardi as the assistant. And they all knew that it was just a matter of time before he was going to be a head coach.
You bet. My goodness, that the New York Giants had two assistant coaches named Tom Landry and Vince Lombardi, and that neither of them ended up being the head coach of the New York Giants. That's a giant oops, Pat. And you know, you're in management of a sports franchise. That's a big oops.
Well, Jim Lee Howe was their coach, and he had good success. He had turned all the most of the coaching duties over to Lombardi and Landry, but they had won. So the Giants were in a tough spot, you know, to fire a very successful coach and a popular guy and replace him with one of those assistants. It just didn't seem right. And the Mara family, so ethical, and they do everything at such a high plane that, you know, that really wasn't going to happen.
So
but
true.
As you can see, both of those coaches went on and had great careers, and I'm sure the Giants, even to this day, miss them.
So true. More with Pat Williams and the life of Coach Lombardi. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Habib, and this is Our American Stories. We're on with Pat Williams, who joins us whenever we're doing an important coach, business leader. We had an amazing time doing 2 hours with Walt Disney, one of which we spent with Pat, and we also did 2 hours on John Wooden, one of which we spent with Pat, and he's written the books on so many of these men, and he's also happens to be the co-founder of the Orlando Magic, has adopted, I've lost count, Pat, at so many kids you've adopted, and you, on as a sideline, you run, what, 4,000, you know, marathons and triathlons, and it's just, you're just a remarkable human being, and thanks so much for taking the time to join us, Pat.
My pleasure, Lee. Nice to talk about Vince Lombardi anytime.
You bet. Hey, let's talk about the role. I'm going to read from you about the role of Coach's faith in his life. And from your book, you write, young Vince's life revolved around the Catholic Church. He was an altar boy at St. Mark's, and he attended Mass every single day until his death. If there was one dimension of Lombardi's life that defined him above all others, it was his faith. Talk about that, Pat.
Well, he grew up in a strong Catholic home in Brooklyn, and listen, there was some sense that he might go into the priesthood, but he was a strong believer in Godly, and he was very, very faithful to his religion. He was at Mass every morning, and that went on his entire life. He talked openly with his team, for example, about his faith and about the importance of God in your life. And he talked very openly also about love and created a bond of love with those players. And we don't think about that when you think of Lombardi, but that was very much a part of who he was. And to this day, his players, you know, still remember that, and that made a deep impact on them.
You know, he did something unusual that I don't think most people knew about, Pat. He went through 4 years of a six-year program to be a priest at Brooklyn's Cathedral College. Talk about that.
Yeah, there were many thoughts, I'm sure, in his mind that he was going to go into the priesthood, and that was going to be his life journey. The football bug bit him, and the rest is history. But he really was, I think, a priest, you know, through his profession, and never really lost sight of the importance of a strong relationship with the Lord in your life. And that's really what drove him. That was a huge part of who he was.
Well, you know, the way that most folks know Coach Lombardi was, well, that old school sort of temper and that old school discipline. And of course, the word discipline comes from the word, in the end, love. I mean, this is how we evidence love in our children's lives, is through discipline. And this was back in a day when, well, folks sounded like this. And Lombardi's style of discipline was infamous for being loud, for being harsh. Some might say cruel and unusual. Americans remember sounds like these.
Hey, supposed to be a hell of a defensive club. It didn't look like it to me.
For God's sake, get him out of there, will you?
Hey, what about that now? He had him on his shirt. He had him on his shoulder pad. He didn't have him on his mask. What the hell's going on out here?
Hey, interference! Interference!
I'll tell you something, Leroy. You're not going to get your job back unless we get a better performance.
Ouch. You know, Coach, look, I'm half Italian, Pat, so I think a part of this has to do with ethnic roots and ethnicity. But talk about this aspect of his coaching style, how the men felt, how the fans felt. And in the end, it's effectiveness, Pat, because this is the bottom line. It's effectiveness.
Well, Lee, he could bark. There's no question. And he could really get after you. He could get after his players to the point that some of them, you know, just didn't handle it well. There's the great story about Bart Starr, his young quarterback. And at the beginning, Lombardi would tear into him, you know, out on the field in front of his players. And Bart Starr really struggled with that. He went home and told his wife and said, listen, I don't mind if he gets after me when we're in his office, but it's really humiliating. How am I meant to lead these guys, you know, if he's constantly tearing into me? And Jerry Starr said, well, Bart, why don't you go in and talk to him? Jerry later said, I never thought he'd do that because Bart didn't really like confrontation. But the next day, sure enough, Bart Starr went in there and said, Coach, if you need to say something to me, please do it in private and keep it that way. It's going to be tough to lead this team, you know, if you're constantly on me. And Bart Starr said, that's the last time, you know, he ever did that. You know, anything he had to say to me, it was always in private. And so Lombardi, you know, could adjust. We often think of him, it's my way or the highway, but he could adjust, and he understood that each one of his players was different, and he could adjust to them.
You have a quote in your book I wanted to read you, Pat. He said this, a good leader must be harder on himself than everyone else. He must first discipline himself before he can discipline others. A man should not ask others to do things he would not have asked himself to do at one time or another in his life. this aspect of discipline, Pat. Talk about that.
Well, I think that was Lombardi. You know, he was down on the field. He was visible. He was present. He wasn't up in an ivory tower, you know, telling people what to do. He was right down among them and lived his life right down among the troops. I think that's what a great leader does. They are visible and available, and they're right there among their players. So, and Lombardi was a great student of human nature. He knew what he was doing. He wasn't just aimlessly, you know, attacking people. He wanted the very best from them. And over time, he learned how to deal with each one of his players and how to motivate each one of those guys and bring out the very best in them. And over that period in the 1960s, well, nobody did it better.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that when Bart Starr comes to coach and offers some advice to coach about how to coach him, he listened. And this gets to that side of discipline that I would call the mercy and understanding side. And a good leader knows how to use both because he knows his men. Pat, talk to us about how in exhibiting the mercy Lombardi's faith taught him, he was able to gain the faith and trust and hard work of his players. And I'm thinking of a story you tell about the backup quarterback, Zeke Bratkowski.
Well, that's one of my favorite stories in the book. I talked to Zeke Bratkowski. He lives up in the panhandle of Florida. He's in his mid-80s, but he told me the story about how, I guess this was the off-season, there was a golf tournament going on, and a bunch of the Packers were in it, and somehow or other, Zeke Bratkowski lost his championship ring, and he was just devastated, just absolutely destroyed, and couldn't find it. Nobody could find it. Apparently, eventually, Vince Lombardi heard about this situation, and that night, with the use of a flashlight, he went back out around parts of the golf course, and darned if he didn't find the ring. And the next day, presented it back to Zeke Bratkowski. And that had to be, gosh, that was, what, 50 years ago? Zeke Bratkowski can't get over it. He's still just dumbfounded that happened, and that Vince Lombardi went to that trouble out there at night with a flashlight and found the ring. So Lombardi cared about his players. They really were his sons to a large degree, and that's why even to this day, his players, elderly men now, you know, have such strong feelings about him.
Yeah, and we're going to play a clip when we come back, and it's from Jerry Kramer. And it's decades after being coached by Coach Lombardi, and he's holding back the tears, a grown man holding back the tears of another grown man coaching him as a grown man 30 years before. This is Lee Habib. I'm with Pat Williams, the co-founder of the Orlando Magic, no better writer on leadership in this country, and the subject, Vince Lombardi. On this day in history, he retired. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Are You Gonna Go By My Way by Lenny Kravitz? And everybody went the way of Vince Lombardi. He got men to play together with common purpose and to love one another. And we're going to talk about how Coach got the men to love one another rather than love him. This is one of the great tactical and strategic decisions great coaches can make and what great leaders can make. But first, I wanted to reintroduce Pat Williams, who's the co-founder of the Orlando Magic, and he has written so many books on leadership, it's hard to remember. But we've done an hour with him on John Wooden, Martin Luther King, Jackie Robinson, Walt Disney. I can go on and on, but we'll cover all of them, hopefully, over the next year, Pat. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a million, Lee. Always good to chat with you.
Same here. I wanted to play you a clip of Jerry Kramer. You know, we learned from Coach Wooden that he knew how to motivate his players, that he was a great psychologist, and he truly understood how to get inside the head of his players. And let's hear from all-time great guard and five-time Pro Bowl and All-Pro guard Jerry Kramer. And then let's get your reaction.
I jumped off sides one time in a scrimmage, and he got in my face, and he said, "Mister, the concentration period of a college student is 5 minutes, high school is 3 minutes, kindergarten is 30 seconds. You don't even have that, so where's that put you?" Put me checking my shoe shine. I go up in the locker room, sitting there, chin in my hand, elbow in my knee, looking at the floor, thinking, I'm never going to play for this guy. He came in the door, came across the room, slapped me on the back of the neck, messed up my hair. He said, "Son, one of these days you're going to be the best guard in football." He turned around and walked away. And that started my motor. With that comment, he allowed me to think about being a great football player. And from that point on, I worked my tail off. I gave him everything I had. It made a profound impact on my life.
One day you're going to be a great football player. Talk about that both that discipline and being hard on the boy, but then quickly thereafter, and this is a grown man who is in many respects still a boy, as we all can be, then that planting of that seed, Pat, the planting of that seed.
Well, Lee, I think the message to all of us is that our words carry enormous impact. And it doesn't matter whether we're an NFL coach or a parent or a teacher, school teacher or whatever. When we say something, we may not think much of it, perhaps, but the receiver of our words will never forget it. So here is Jerry Kramer with that little sentence. It was one sentence that Lombardi planted in him, and Jerry Kramer said, "That was the turning point in my career and a major turning point in my life." Amazing, isn't it?
It really is. Yep.
The power of our words, the power of the impact of our lives on other people. And yep. So there's a marvelous example of that in action. And I bet, Lee, any person can sit down and look back over their life and say, it was a word when I was 7 years old, or a derogatory word when I was 12, and I've never forgotten it, or something. You know, we never forget the impact of other people on our life and the words that they say to us. And whether we're 5 years old or 75, you know, those words stick. So Lombardi understood that, and Jerry Kramer was the beneficiary.
You bet. You know, you wrote in your book, and I'm going to quote two specific passages from the great defensive end Willie Davis. And imagine a young African-American player going all the way up to this part of America where, boy, my goodness, there aren't a lot of African-Americans, and it's cold, and Willie's wondering what's going on. But here's what he says about Coach. "Coach Lombardi taught football and life in a way that helped you picture it in your mind. When he spoke, you could actually visualize doing what he said. You thought, I can do this, and I can become successful with it. And later you said, he could hear his voice from a block away, and when you heard it, you felt something. His emotion, it became yours. You could be exhausted, spent, unable to move, but then Coach Lombardi would start talking and he'd get your blood pumping. And soon you were ready to go out and run your heart out for him. Emotion, he had it, and he communicated it to us." Talk about this communication thing and also this vision thing, because they do go hand in hand. If you're going to communicate, what are you communicating? How are you communicating it? And what are you pointing people towards? Talk about those things, Pat.
Well, I think the first two qualities of great leaders, first of all, is vision, and secondly, communicating your vision. And Lombardi was a visionary. We've got a story in there about John Madden, who I got to talk to And John Madden talked about Lombardi's greatest strength was his vision. He knew where he wanted to take those Packers. He knew what the success was about. And he knew in his mind, well, he saw the finished product and then worked backwards, putting the pieces in place to turn that vision into reality. But Lombardi also knew that if you couldn't communicate your vision effectively and repeatedly, that vision really wasn't going to do anything. It wasn't going anywhere. And that was another great strength of his. He had a strong voice. You knew that he was there. And, yeah, he could bark. He could also be tender. He did a lot of yelling and picked his spots pretty well. But those players responded to him, and they knew exactly what he was saying and what he was trying to accomplish. So when you study great leaders, Lee, every single one of them, they all had a vision. They were all very strong and faithful in that vision, and they had the ability to communicate their vision.
Yeah, and we learned that.
Two vital parts of being a great leader.
Yep, and we learned that in our discussion of Bear Bryant, if you remember. And there was that clip I had played you where all the boys who are now men were looking back at their lives with Coach Bryant. And it was interesting because you could tell that Bear's toughness had gotten them to bond closer together. Those boys had gone through a crucible together. And this was obviously and clearly part of what Bear was up to. And I can only guess this is what Coach Lombardi was up to, too.
Well, I think there are many similarities between Bear Bryant and Vince Lombardi. They were strong. They were tough. They could bark. Their players were intimidated by them to a certain degree. But they were both teaching life. And all of Bear Bryant's players told me the same thing, that he was getting us ready for the long pull of life, far beyond football. Now, he was a college coach with much younger players, but Lombardi was doing the same thing as a pro coach. You know, he was investing in those players and getting them ready for a long lifetime after football. So both of them, and I think all great coaches really are great teachers. Remember what Lombardi said, they call it coaching, but it's really teaching.
Yep.
So to be a great leader of any sort, you really have to be an outstanding teacher. You've got to work at it. You've got to really develop an ability to teach. And above all, you've got to be a lifelong learner, because you can't be a lifelong teacher if you're not a lifelong learner.
That's so true. And you know, in your book, Pat, you were talking about the three things that are essential for building any winning team, whether sports, business, life, a church. And it's teach fundamentals, maintain discipline, and three, instill a sense of mutual love. And I wanted to do another quick reading from your book, and this is from Lombardi himself. Quote, if you're going to play together as a team, you've got to care for one another. You've got to love each other. Each player has to be thinking about the next guy and saying, if I don't block that man, my friend is going to get his legs broken. I need to do my job so he can do his. Talk about that.
Well, there's a lot to that, isn't there? At the end of the day, you know, great football teams are built by being great teammates and having a great sense of unity. And Lombardi was constantly stressing that. Every great coach does. Every great organization, I think, is made up of teamwork. There's an interesting story about Jerry Richardson, the Carolina Panthers owner, you know, who started that team up from scratch as an expansion team. And he had his first meeting with the business community in Charlotte. And he said, excuse me, may I come to the point? I want you to know how we do things. Number one, we believe in teamwork. Number two, we're always on time. Number three, we do what we're going to do. We do what we say we're going to do. That's Jerry Richardson, the owner of the Panthers in Charlotte, you know, at his first meeting in the business community. So teamwork carries the day, Lee. It always has, always will.
Well, Pat, we really appreciate you joining us. We wanted to go out, and I thank you for always doing this. We're talking to Pat Williams, the co-founder of the Orlando Magic. He's written so many books on leadership, I can't count them. But Vince Lombardi is among many. And we're going to go out, Pat, listening to Vince Lombardi who is not just a visionary, but what a communicator. And here is rare audio of Vince Lombardi giving a pep talk just before Super Bowl II.
You're the only team, maybe, in the history of the National Football League will ever have this opportunity to do it twice. Boys, I'm proud of you. I'd be so proud of that. I just fill up. Talk about it, come easy. This is a club that's going to hit you. They're going to try to hit you, and you're going to take it out of them. Just hit, just run, just block, and just tackle. You do that, there's no question what the answer is going to be this morning. Keep your poise. There's nothing that they can show you out there. You have to face a number of times, right?
Right.
Pat, thanks so much for joining us. Much appreciated, as always.
Lee, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
You bet. And this is Lee Habib. And listen to the frankness, the simplicity with which Coach motivates his boys, like they're predestined to win this game. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we love music here. Americans love music, and my goodness, we've invented all kinds of music. You're listening to Elton John, who came to America and fell in love with our blues music. This song, Benny and the Jets, well, it topped the R&B charts, and Elton became the first white person to ever perform on Soul Train, which had been an ambition of his. A deep ambition. Imagine that, a white British kid hung up. We learned that about Robert Plant. White British kid comes to the Delta, to Clarksdale, Mississippi, learns the blues, goes back to England, forms a little band called Led Zeppelin. Well, today for the hour, we're going to spend some time on a list that Jesse stumbled upon on the web, omgfacts.com, the top 20 records of all time by just sheer sales, not opinion, not Rolling Stone and the Sherpas over there and gurus telling us what to think about what the best music is. No, this is just the music the country bought. The American people voted, and these were the biggest records of all time. And that's Elton John's Benny and the Jets from Elton John's Greatest Hits, the 1974 compilation album. And the 11th official release for Elton. And it topped the charts in the United States and the United Kingdom, staying at number one for 10 consecutive weeks, which is a lifetime. And it's his best-selling album to date, being his first to have received an RIAA Diamond certification for U.S. sales at more than 16 million copies, which is why it's on this list. And we're going to rip through these for the hour. We're going to rip through all 20. Actually, we have 21. And my favorite on the record is track number 6, Jesse, Rocket Man. And it just always feels like the first time when I hear this.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space on such a timeless flight. Touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh no, 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 I'm a rocket man. Rocket man, burning out as you long.
It doesn't get much better than that, folks. That was off his Honky Chateau record. And that was when Elton was merging country influences, a lot of steel guitars on that record. Really simple Americana, you'd call it today.
Sounds cliche, but it takes you on a ride.
Yeah. It
so
does.
Big. Did he write that for the movie?
No, he just wrote it, and then it's been used 100 different ways.
I was just kidding. Yeah. You know the movie Rocket Man? Not a funny joke.
That was 20 years
That's
out.
Why it was funny. All right, well, the number 20, and we did a whole segment on not only this song, but we also did a real honorarium on and a tribute to Glenn Frey, who co-wrote this song. And the record is Hotel California. It's the fifth studio album by the Eagles, and one of the best-selling of all time. Three singles, The New Kid in Town, Life in the Fast Lane, and this, the title track. It sold 16 million copies in the United States alone. Let's listen to Don Henley. Number 19 is a little British band that sold a hell of a lot of records in the United States. And there's Led Zeppelin. We were talking just about Robert Plant a bit ago. And go on our website, OurAmericanNetwork.org, and listen to our half hour on Robert Plant and his two trips to America to discover himself. First, the blues, and then later on in his life, American roots music and the Band of Joy. Physical Graffiti is their sixth studio album. And my goodness, it doesn't get better. My favorite, by the way, of all the Zeppelin records. And that's because it has track number 6, Cashmere, on it. Jimmy Page comes up with this riff. And then that distinctive voice of Robert Plant coming in over the guitars, over the great drum work of John Bonham. This was not a single record, by the way. It was a double. And the songs aren't short. The songs are complex. They take you places that you, well, only Zeppelin could take you on. And very few choruses and breakdowns. Very unusual writing. A very unusual and brilliant band. Let's go out with Robert Plant and Jimmy Page. Number 19, Physical Graffiti. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Top 20 albums. We're going through them this hour of all time. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we love music, and we love to talk about music and play music and tell stories. And, well, the greatest music always tells a story and actually brings you back to places. And it brings you back to places in ways almost nothing else does. So you're listening to Metallica's Enter Sandman. And this is number 18. From the list that Jesse dug up from omgfacts.com, the top 20 records of all time, not opinion, just record sales. How the American public voted with their pocketbooks. with their money. So this isn't about opinions, folks. This is just omgfacts.com. We thought it was fun. We thought we'd rip through them for you because we were surprised at some of them. And some of them were like, OMG, why are they here?
Yeah, there's no way that that black album of Metallica is better than Injustice for All or Ride the Lightning.
A lot of Metallica fans didn't like this album because it was considered their sellout album.
I remember when it came out. Yeah. I remember. It was in 89 or 90. I remember that. Yeah. And it was just not that great. It wasn't classic Metallica. I
you think guys are snobs. The people have spoken.
The people have spoken.
Forget the people.
16 million people were wrong.
A reporter approached the drummer, Lars Ulrich, about this album. He says, have you guys sold out? And Lars said, yeah, we sold out. We sell out every night.
That's pretty funny. And that's why Lars is a drummer and not a stand-up.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you who didn't sell out, because everybody thought these guys were sort of sellouts anyway. This is just a straight pop band. And it's, of course, Cracked Rear View by Hootie and the Blowfish. And, of course, Hold My Hand was just a gigantic, gigantic hit for them.
With a little love and some tenderness, we'll walk upon the water, we'll rise above the mist. With a little peace and some harmony, we'll take the world together, we'll take them by the hand.
The critical reviews were mostly positive, but soon thereafter, the critics started really dumping on Hootie and the Blowfish. But let me tell you, they sold a lot of records. 16 million.
Wow. Makes me want to get my hacky sack out and go throw a frisbee in the park or something.
It does. It does.
Takes you back.
Did you guys hear about Hootie's car? Didn't he do something crazy with his car? Put like military equipment or something.
I like how everybody calls the lead singer Hootie. His name's not Hootie.
He's not Hootie.
That was just to set you up, Greg.
Thanks.
Well, let's go to number 16, and it's a country act and a great writer. Say what you want about this guy, whatever you think about this guy, he writes his stuff, and his name is Garth Brooks. And, well, in 1990, No Fences reached number one on the Billboard Top Country Album charts, and my goodness, this one sold a couple of records, too. 17 million, and, well, I don't think there's a better bar song than this one by Garth. And, well, the lyrics are just so darn good.
Blame it all on my roots. I showed up in boots and ruined your black tie affair. The last one to know, the last one to show, I was the last one you thought you'd see there. And I saw the surprise and the fear in his eyes when I took his glass of champagne. And I toasted you, said, honey, we may be through, but you'll never hear me complain. 'Cause I got friends in low places where the whiskey...
And Garth, well, he went on to sell so many more records. I don't think there was a bigger selling country act. Meanwhile, his favorite acts were rock acts. Billy Joel, too.
James Taylor. Alex, did you ever sing this one in a bar?
Yeah, it was like 3 a.m. Jesse and I were talking about it earlier. This is one of the few karaoke songs we've done.
Nice.
Yeah. with a bunch of friends.
Guilty.
We want the video. We want the video. Well, now we get to number 15, and this takes me back to my high school days, and I'll never forget hearing this for the first time through a car speaker and going, what the heck is this? And it was this band called Boston. And there was this song, and it was the way they layered the guitars. And, I mean, we played this. Everybody played this until, well, you couldn't listen to it anymore, and then you listen to it some more.
This morning, and the sun was gone.
And by the way, what was really funny is having a few drinks and trying to get through the chorus, and nobody knew the words. Nobody knew them. I feel like a zombie, I feel like I'm zoning, and it doesn't matter. And we don't even want to know what the words are.
I think there are more Boston cover bands in Los Angeles than any other band.
Wow.
Yeah. And by the way, that one sold 17 million copies too. My goodness. Not a bad debut record. Next on the list, well, it's a soundtrack from a movie. And we just covered one of the writers of the big songs on this, Dolly Parton. And Whitney Houston belted it out. And I think it's why the soundtrack sold as many copies as it did. And of course, it was the soundtrack to The Bodyguard. And this one, well, it was Whitney and Clive Davis. And Clive, my goodness, we've got to do an hour on Clive Davis because he's another one of those record impresarios like Ahmet Ertegun, who we covered, who is the founder of Atlantic Records. And go to our website, OurAmericanNetwork.org, and listen to that hour. The man who discovered Ray Charles, who took the Stones to a new place, and Led Zeppelin, and Otis Redding, and Aretha Franklin. It just goes on and on. One guy. Well, 17 million copies, and the hit song that everybody knows and everybody remembers, Dolly's own, I Will Always Love You.
If I should stay, I would only be in your way. So I'll go, but I know I'll think of you every step of the way. And
whatever kind of music you listen to, it doesn't get much better in terms of pure singing and pure writing than that. And I'm not a big pop fan. But oh my goodness, if you don't get moved by that, you got to examine your heart. Chuck yourself into a clinic. Get the thing cleaned out. Heal thyself. Let's hear a little bit more from Whitney. And when we come back, we'll dig into the Beatles, Guns N' Roses, so much more. This is Our American Stories. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and catch all of what we do. Today, the top 20 best-selling records of all time, compiled by OMGFacts.com with a little help from Jesse Edwards. More after this. And this is Our American Stories. And for the hour, the top 20 selling albums of all time. And I mean gross record sales. No opinions here, nothing subjective. Bicker with these numbers if you like, but the American people voted with their wallets. And this was assembled by OMGFacts.com. And we thought, what the heck? Let's rip through these. And this one, of course, well, that's the Beatles. But it's not from Revolver, which is where the song originally appeared. It's actually from the Beatles' 1967 to 1970, widely known as the Blue Album. There was a red companion as well. And this one sold 17 million records. Number 13. All right. And my goodness, there are so many big hits on this that you can't go through the Beatles catalog without just being humbled. And they did it all in about 6 years. In about 6 years, they wrote some of the best records of all time. Next on the list, number 12. This may be the greatest opening guitar riff to any song ever written, my humble opinion. My wife's favorite band. You don't mess with that. And the record, Appetite for Destruction, the band. Well, we know the band, and it's Guns N' Roses. Let's take a listen. That was 1987.
Wow.
Geffen Records. Over and over, Geffen Records just found the talent. Way back when they signed Laura Nyro and a little girl named Joni Mitchell. Then through rock and roll, then right up to the Counting Crows. I mean, I could just go on and on with the talent Geffen and his guys had for finding talent. This record, the best-selling debut album ever. 11th best-selling album in the United States. 18 million sold. Not bad. Let's look at number 11. Oh my goodness, we're back to that British band and an album known as the White Album. And the George Harrison composition, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, maybe one of the best, but my goodness, you could argue over and over again about which one was the best, a double record. And that's the thing about the Beatles. Harrison could come in and slay you. Then Lennon would come in with one of his compositions, McCartney with one of his. Everything said Lennon and McCartney, but the fact of the matter is, if you know anything about the Beatles, one of them generally wrote most of the song, and then the other one would take it over the hump, so they just shared writing credit. But this was written solely by George Harrison. Let's take a listen. Sleeping
while my guitar gently weeps.
And now we're cracking into the top 10. Another British band and a blues band. Again, they started with the blues with a guy named Mick Fleetwood in the pit. And then ultimately, they just kept adding great singers and songwriters. And the band is Fleetwood Mac. And the album, Rumours, a perfect record. And, well, the big hit on that record, well, it was this. Lindsey Buckingham, Go Your Own Way. Take a listen. What was so interesting about this band is they had multiple singers. So you'd go from a rocker like this to something like track two and the remarkable vocals of Stevie Nicks.
There you go.
we're breaking into the top 10 and we're down to number 9. And Come On Over was the third studio album recorded by this Canadian singer, Shania Twain, released in 1997, and it sold a whopping 20 million copies. 20 million copies. Love Shania, don't love her, she's on this list, and here's just one of the big tracks that everybody knows from this moment on.
From this moment, life has begun. From this moment, you are the one. Right beside you is where I belong. From this moment on, from this moment,
now we're looking at number 8, and he's already had one on this list, No Fences. And Double Live is the first and only live album by an American country music artist to chart as it did. And again, it's Garth Brooks, a 2-disc live album that sold 21 million copies. And The Dance, which Garth wrote, maybe one of his finest. Let's take a listen.
Looking back on memory of the dance we shared beneath the stars above. For a moment, all the world was right. How could I have known you'd ever say goodbye? And that, glad I didn't know where it all would end.
And we're going to now squeeze in the number 7 album. And it's the 7th studio album by an Australian band. And the album is Back in Black. And, well, You Shook Me All Night Long. They still play it at every stadium in America.
Every time.
Every time. And it still rocks the house. Guess how many copies? 22 million. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Story. The top 20 albums of all time. We're running through them. Right here. We'll be back with more. We'll go out with You Shook Me All Night Long by AC/DC. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're hearing the opening riff from Billy Joel's Piano Man. We're ripping through the top 20 albums of all time, not subjective, the top 20 sellers of all time. OMGFacts.com put out the list. We were just loving it, so we figured let's spend an hour and rip through it. And this is Billy Joel's Greatest Hits Collection, double album, sold 23 million copies. And, well, this was one of the greatest songs. This launched his career, this song. But what made Billy Billy was his ballads. When you'd go to a concert and break everything down And then there was no denying this guy's talent as a writer and a singer, because there he was alone at Madison Square Garden and playing something like this.
She's got a way about her. I don't know what it is, but I know that I can't live without her. She's got a way of pleasing. I don't know why it is, but there doesn't have to be a reason anyway.
And now we're getting to number five. And it was the 11th studio album by this English progressive rock band. Some call them Floyd. And it's Pink Floyd. And again, we did a great segment on this song, how it was made, how it got stuck in the studio, and what unstuck it. And we don't want to tell you anymore. Go to our website, ouramericannetwork.org, and hear the story, as told by Roger Waters and some of the school kids who actually recorded the chorus. That background of the chorus. And we're listening to Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2. This record sold, well, in 1979, it was released. And 23 million purchases later, this made its way to number 5 on the list. And now we get to number 4, and, well, it's the same band. It's Pink Floyd, and it's The Dark Side of the Moon. And it sold 24 million albums. It was an immediate success. Recorded in Abbey Road Studios in London in two sessions, in 1972 and 1973. The group used some of the most advanced recording techniques of the time, including multi-track recording and tape loops. Let's take a listen to Time. There haven't been many bands like it before and since. And you just have to put that record on and play it from beginning to end. And by the way, if you have vinyl and you got a great, great turntable, nothing sounds better than vinyl. And thank goodness for the hipsters. They're bringing vinyl back. And now on to number 3. The untitled 4th studio album by the English rock band Led Zeppelin. Physical Graffiti was there earlier. Known as Four, Led Zeppelin Four. Produced by Jimmy Page. Recorded between 1970 and 71 at several locations. Mostly in a home. In England. A home recording. Can you imagine that? Four had so many great songs. Black Dog, Rock and Roll, Misty Mountain Hop, Going to California. And of course, it had this, their signature song, the song everybody wished they'd written.
If there's a bustle in your hedgerow, don't be alone there. It's just a sprinkling for the make queen. Yes, there are two paths you can go by, but in the long run, there's still time to change the road you're on.
The record would go on to sell 25 million albums. Not bad. And of course, when John Bonham died, so did Zeppelin. And how many bands, when they lose a drummer, fold it up? And that's how tight a band this was. And that's how great a drummer John Bonham was.
Your head is humming and it won't go, in case you don't know.
You know, people may not have liked the record labels, and they're dead now. But YouTube is not producing this kind of music, folks. It just ain't. Now, I can't wait for the labels to make a resurgence, for an A&R guy to find a band like this, and I'm out Ertegun to get behind a band like this. There's no chorus. This is an 8-minute song. It has no beginning and middle and end in a way. It's just one seamless piece of art. Now we're on to number two, a very different kind of record, but what a big one. And it's Thriller. Epic Records, Michael Jackson. Recorded at Westlake Recording Studio in L.A. with a budget of $750,000, a pretty big one back then, and assisted by a guy who knew a thing or two about making records, way back to the great records he made with Frank Sinatra, Quincy Jones. The album's 9 tracks, 4 were written by Jackson, 7 singles were released from the album, all of which were released, all of which made the top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100. It would go on to sell 29 million records. Let's take a listen to Thriller. And what Jackson did with his videos was as remarkable as what he did with this record. And I think whatever you thought of MTV, at its height, it was such a pleasure. And one day we'll have to do the top 20 MTV videos of all time. But Jackson took making videos to another place. Another place. And that brings us to the number one record of all time. They had one earlier. And it was a little hit called Hotel California. But this record, the Eagles' Greatest Hits, well, it was the first compilation album by the Eagles. It was released in 76. If you own a car and you drive and you don't have this record, there's something wrong with you. Or you're just a hater from this really great band from California, because they had a lot of haters. But it was the best-selling album in the United States and the best-selling album of the 20th century. It would go on to sell over 30 million albums. Let's take a listen to Take It Easy.
Take it easy, take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy. Like no
Maybe it was because they were too good looking. Maybe it was because the girls liked him. Maybe it was because those melodies were so sweet. Maybe it was because they were such great singers. Maybe it was because they were such great writers. So many people had no respect for this band, but the numbers don't lie on this one, folks. 40 million. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the 20 best-selling albums of all time, brought to you by our team. Thanks, Jesse, for all the work on this. And go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear all of what we do.
So open up, I'm climbing in. So take it easy.